This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Now here's something that came as a surprise to me, and I'm imagining it's going to come as a surprise to a lot of you as well. Our nation is in the midst of a silent epidemic of toileting troubles. No one gets onto Facebook and says, oh, my kid wet the bed again, but accidents and bedwetting and urinary tract infections are rampant and they're on the rise. These messy and, you know, embarrassing problems are stressful for parents and for kids alike, but they're typically dismissed. You know, kids are kids or she'll outgrow it, or they're misdiagnosed or they're undertreated. And that's because most parents and many pediatricians are not aware of one very important research-proven fact. Virtually all childhood potty problems are caused by holding the poop or the pee or both. A lot of the problems have to do with our Western lifestyle and the pressure that we put on parents and kids to get toilet trained too early. There's also inadequate potty training follow-up and misguided school policies. In today's show, we're going to get, if you'll forgive the expression, the real poop about potty problems from a doctor who actually specializes in these kinds of things. We're going to learn how to recognize the sometimes subtle signs of holding it in, and we're going to get some research-based strategies for resolving all of the wetting and holding episodes that may be causing your child and you a lot of stress.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
I'm 4 years old, and I'm the only one in my whole class that can tie his own shoes.
My mom took me to the circus for my birthday. Half my friends already went, but now I've gone too.
Most kids make fun of me because I still believe in the tooth fairy. But I got $5 yesterday, I believe.
A third of the kids in my 8th grade class drink alcohol regularly.
Over 99% of my class has been offered illegal drugs. Half of my college classmates binge drink, abuse drugs, or do both. But the frequent dinners I had with my family have helped make sure I'm not one of them.
Go to CasaFamilyDay.org. Take the Family Day Pledge and get tips on how to talk to your kids about drugs and alcohol. Have dinner with them often, and you can significantly lower their risk of substance abuse. Dinner makes a difference. A message from the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Steve Hodges, who's the author of It's No Accident, Breakthrough Solutions to Your Child's Wetting, Constipation, UTIs, and Other Potty Problems. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm curious, that you have a completely different take on a lot of the potty training stuff, and believe me, I can tell you that I get an inordinate number of potty training books that show up here. And it was interesting. I don't want to say refreshing exactly, but it was a little kind of coming from left field. Tell us about your particular take on these things.
Yeah. So in my clinic, it was clear to me early on in my career that early toilet training was bad in terms of it led to more problems, and I saw that just every day. And then when I looked through the literatures, it was interesting that most of the data is actually the opposite, and that maybe. Be what you're referring to is a lot of data shows that if you train later, you can have worse problems with incontinence or overactivity. I think the last paper I saw showed that very early training was bad and then late training was bad, so there was a magic window around 2. So I did my own study before the book came out, and we actually got the same data, which was shocking to me that, you know, early training was bad and late training was bad, and that around the middle, it seemed to be a magic window. But it didn't make a physiologic sense to me because I know what causes bladder overactivity and what can lead to it. So we looked a little deeper, and we found that the kids that most studies that have been published said that trained late and had problems were almost assuredly already either constipated or had some bowel issues, which were hampering bladder function, so they didn't really have a chance to avoid normally.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the kids we see either train late and were constipated, or tried to train early and were constipated and then had difficulty training, so didn't train until they were much later.
Okay, so let's talk about a little bit of an idea about what this whole window is. When you're talking about early and late, I mean, you hear every once in a while somebody will talk about how, well, in Sweden or whatever, you know, they're toilet training their kids at 9 months or 6 months or something like that, and there's occasionally a book that shows up about how you can potty train your child at 6 or 8 months. That seems way early to me, and so I would like to get a little bit of a better sense from you about what early is and what late is, and you said about two, but there's a difference for boys and girls, right? So,
yeah, I think in general, I consider them as a group. I mean, sometimes it seems like girls train a little easier, but I wouldn't try to train any child before three. And I think the disconnect or the misunderstanding people have is that when it's possible to train a child and when it's wise to train a child are very different. It's possible to train them very early. And in certain countries maybe where there's different diets or different access issues to the bathroom, maybe bathrooms are more available, it may not be as big a deal. But in America, where I can speak personally, training early is a bad problem, because the way you need to look at it is it from the age of toilet training on is when the child, the decision to whether when the child goes to the bathroom is in the child's hands, right? So the earlier that happens, the worse it is, really, because children often make poor decisions in terms of when to go to the bathroom. And that early holding, because they'll always put it off, leads to more problems later. So, we have actually really pretty good studies out there about bladder growth, and we see that the bladder grows when it has kind of uninhibited emptying, when you're just emptying into a diaper. And that growth tapers off rapidly after training. So these kids that we see in my clinic with wetting and accidents and so forth, that problem developed from training on.
Go back just a second, though, because I didn't quite get that whole thing about the bladder growth.
So, yes, this is an interesting point. So the bladder is a muscle, but it grows. When you're born, it's not a huge size, and it grows in the first few years of life because the gentle stretching of the bladder, which happens as it fills, because, you know, an infant doesn't void until it's a reflex happens. It doesn't really make a decision to void. It just reflexively empties the bladder.
Mm-hmm.
And that gentle stretching and then emptying without holding is what leads to bladder growth. Once you start feeling the urge to void and kind of preventing it by holding it, you strain the bladder, and it makes the bladder wall thicker because you're straining the bladder. And as you imagine, if you have a circular or spherical organ, as the wall gets thicker, the actual volume it can hold gets smaller.
Oh, that's interesting. I would have thought it'd be exactly the opposite, which is, I guess, what most people think, is that if you hold on to it, there'll be more and more and more in it, and then you'll eventually have a bigger bladder.
Oh, yeah, that's such bad advice, which is very common. One of the reasons we wrote the book, because a lot of pediatricians, even well-meaning pediatricians, will tell children if they have urinary frequency or urgency just to try to hold, to kind of train the bladder to hold more.
Mm-hmm.
But the bladder is a muscle, so the more you strain it, the more it hypertrophies or get bigger, just like any other muscle. But also, as it lays down more muscle, it kind of fibroses a bit, so it gets harder, so it becomes less compliant. So it turns from kind of a balloon with a thin wall to a balloon kind of with a thick wall, if you can imagine.
Yeah.
So it's much harder to expand and hold urine, and that's what causes a lot of the problems.
Is that a permanent change? Or if you went back to more of a normal usage, that you would eventually, in the same way that if you didn't work out a lot, your muscles would get a little smaller?
Exactly. It's temporary, and kids have great recovery, you know, because they're so pliable and they can recover from anything. So the sooner you reverse that process, the bladder can recover and get bigger again. So that's one of the first steps we do is kind of we take away the inhibition in these children. We put them on a voiding schedule, so they're not kind of deciding when to go anymore, but the parents are telling them when to go.
Now, one of the things I thought was really interesting about the book and the materials that I got that I was looking at before we set up this interview was the idea of holding it, and that really seems to be at the core of a lot of the problems that there are. How does that work? I mean, you're saying that it's thickening the wall of the bladder, but you're also talking about holding not only urine.
Oh, yeah, so there's two components, and I actually think the stool component happens first, because I think it's a little bit easier for kids to learn to void in the potty as opposed to pooping in the potty. And when they change their diet to maybe whole milk or regular food, they for the first time start having painful bowel movements. And they're just like anyone, if something's painful, they'll tend to put it off a little bit. And so as they withhold going to the bathroom to poop, it can build up behind the bladder. So that excessive stool can cause pressure on the bladder and then make the bladder overactive, which then causes them to hold the bladder more. So you get kind of this positive feedback loop where the holding just progressively becomes worse, and then you see the bladder of activity being initiating due to the bowel issue. But then once the bladder has become hypertrophied or changes due to the chronic holding, then it's got issues of its own. And then we see this a lot in some kids that will present with minimal symptoms, such as a urinary urgency or frequency, where they have to go to the bathroom quickly or frequently. It's almost solely due to the bowels. But as they progress and get worse symptoms, such as daytime wetting, and most assuredly in those children, there's been some changes in the bladder itself, which need therapy as well.
You see a lot of kids like this. So you're not just a pediatrician, you're a pediatric urologist. So you're seeing, I'm guessing they only show up in your office when there's a problem.
Oh, yeah. I guess I do see a kind of a skewed population, because everyone in my clinic is someone that's had problems for a while. But it's literally half my clinic. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is that a lot of the parents would come in, and you know, a lot of times people may be put off this issue, say, well, there's just a kid being a kid, don't worry about it. And so years go by before they see me, and the problem's a lot worse. And also, there weren't a lot of resources available for parents. If you're a parent, you know, there's common understanding for certain diseases, what causes them, you know, not to give a child like aspirin if they have measles or whatever for Reye syndrome. And there's things that are known out there, but in terms of why these wedding episodes develop, there's not good information for lay people. So that's one of the reasons we wrote the book, because parents come in with all sorts of theories, and most of them, you know, aren't based in fact.
So what's too late in this process? When is it too late to start
to train?
Yeah.
In my opinion, the problems I see, never. You know, I figure, and we, a lot of parents say the same thing when they're kind of on board with me. I mean, these kids, you know, your child's not going to go to college, you know, in diapers, obviously. So anytime they, you know, at some point, some peer pressure, or just, you know, they're the last kid in class and pull-ups, and they want to go. So there's rare kids that they'll be close to four, you know, or past four, and just not, they've been in diapers so long they don't want to get out of them. And at some point you do have to maybe force the issue and say, look, you know, we have to do it. And that's a little bit of trouble, but that's way easier than reversing the bladder overactivity that may develop in kids that train very early.
Stephen Hodges is the author of It's No Accident, Breakthrough Solutions to Your Child's Wedding, Constipation, UTIs, and Other Potty Problems. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to continue talking with Stephen about some of the potty problems and also to get some real concrete information about how you do go about training a child and dealing with problems as they arise. I'm Armin Brott. You're listening to Positive Parenting.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
I walk and you drive. So let's make a deal. I'll watch for you and cross the street safely. You watch for me and stop. Think of the impact we can make.
A message from the Federal Highway Administration.
When you have breast cancer, these are some of the first words you hear. HER2 new oncogene, ductal carcinoma in situ. What do they mean? How can you decide what to do if you can't even say what you have? This is Olivia Newton-John. You can go to breastcancer.org, a special place on the internet where you can learn how to say all those medical words and find out what they mean, understand your diagnosis and your treatment options. Breastcancer.org, the first place to go the minute you find out you have breast cancer.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and if you're just joining us, we're continuing our discussion with Stephen Hodges, who is the author of It's No Accident, Breakthrough Solutions to Your Child's Wedding, Constipation, UTIs, and Other Potty Problems. Stephen, let's talk a little bit about You've mentioned a couple times that you don't want to start too soon, you don't want to start too late. How do you go about starting with a child who doesn't seem to be having any problems? How do you start? How do you figure out when they're even possibly emotionally ready for the whole thing?
They have to have, you know, an interest, first of all. Otherwise, you know, you're never going to win. And so typically, once they have an interest, and if they're after three, then you basically introduce the concept of going. They have to be able to dress and undress themselves. That's important because you have to get to the bathroom and be able to actually, you know, to void. They have to be able to tell you when they need to go and communicate that need and sense it themselves. I don't like to focus on the training as much because that's where the problems happen. What I like to focus and tell parents is, number one thing is make sure that once the child starts regular diet, that their stools are very, very, not loose, but soft and regular. A lot of kid parents will miss constipation children because they think that formed large stools are normal in children. The stools should be very mushy. We like to make food analogies like, you know, hummus or mashed potatoes or a thick milkshake, but that's really what you need. And early on, if you develop constipation issues with a child and they're not addressed, it can lead to difficulty training. So you need to talk to your pediatrician if your child has those problems, even in diapers, to see whether you need to add any laxatives or extra fiber to help that. And then once they're in the mode to where they're interested in training, you just have them go on a schedule and have them try to go. And usually they'll pick it up very quickly. But what you want to focus on is emptying. So what you don't want to do is make it difficult or something hard for the child to do or that they're punished for when they don't empty. You don't want them to be holding. Mm-hmm. So some kids, you know, catch on very quickly with toilet training and they fly with it. Others have difficulty, and those kids, I don't like to, you know, force them to drop, be dry or punish them, but keep them pull-ups if they need so they can go to the bathroom and release either in the toilet or in their pull-ups if they don't have time to get to the bathroom.
Now, I think one of the things I'm guessing you would probably be hearing a little bit of a pushback from some people, because a lot of people put their kids into daycare around age two or slightly before, and I remember when I was putting my kids in those situations, a lot of them want to have the kids potty trained by two. And so you're going to have all these parents who are going to be saying, oh, hold on just a second. You're suggesting that we now have to keep our kid at home for another year?
That's very true. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book is that I think that forced training is bad because some kids aren't ready, you know. And I don't really see, you know, again, I don't want to tell other people their business, and I know it's difficult to take care of these kids, but I don't really see the harm in letting kids at any age come to a, you know, preschool or a camp in pull-ups. And if they have, you know, if they have to go, then just have them changed. Because I really think we name certain causes of, you know, that we believe have developed this epidemic of potty problems in our children. And one of them is the school system or the preschool system, which encourages early training. And then once the children are trained, has them, you know, in an environment where maybe they're not comfortable going. So really it's a setup for problems, because you're taking a three-year-old kid, you know, that's really not gone to the bathroom on their own, and then forcing them out of pull-up, out of diapers, and putting them in an environment where maybe they may not be comfortable going. So you introduce holding very early, and we think that's bad.
One thing I'm kind of curious about is the, I don't know, the overlap or the confusion sometimes between things like diarrhea and constipation, and you in some ways, or not in some ways, you actually have a diagram of it, which is an odd-looking thing, but you're saying that in sometimes kids who look like they have diarrhea are actually constipated. How can you tell the difference?
Yeah, so that's a very important point. And one of the main components of my research has been just teasing out normal bowel habits in children, because the most commonly the children we see in my office with voiding problems, complaints such as urinary urgency or having to rush to the bathroom or urinary frequency or incontinence day or night while sleeping or while awake, have completely normal bowel habits. The parents will say, you know, they void daily, they have soft stools. Some of these kids I was treating were not getting better, I looked a little deeper into it and found that if you x-ray them, they actually are actually full of stool, mostly in the very end of the colon called the rectum. So constipation, as the colloquial definition of, you know, voiding daily with soft stools, doesn't really fit with kids. With kids, what you got to make sure, if they're having voiding problems, is that their rectum or the end of their colon is empty. So a lot of these kids would come in, and we'd put them on laxatives, and the parents would quit the laxatives because they were having diarrhea, and they'd stop. So, but the voiding problems would still be there. So we'd bring them back, and we'd get another x-ray, and we'd see, you know, the stool is still there. And what happens is you have hardened stool at the end of the colon, and if you're flushing through a lot of laxatives, a lot of the loose stool will just pass around the hard stool and cause diarrhea, and you haven't solved the problem. So that's why I think it's important to image these children somehow, either with ultrasound or x-ray, to see exactly what's going on. Because a lot of times what's coming out the bottom isn't really telling you the whole story.
Wow. Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about bedwetting and things like that that are going on well into the school years, 5, 6, 7 years old. Is that normal? And how, as a parent, can you deal with that?
Yeah, this is a kind of an area I'm trying to champion, and I don't want to be too dogmatic, but, you know, for the near, you know, recorded time in urology, we've had three common causes of bedwetting that we understood. One was that children that wet the bed tend to make a little bit more urine at night. Two was that they tend to be a little bit more difficult to arouse. And three was that their bladder was overactive. And since bedwetting was so common, we wouldn't even begin treating it until they were seven or so. And then we'd treat one of those three areas with various therapies that we have. What we found in our research is, and what was printed by Dr. O'Regan back in the 80s and somehow either misunderstood or kind of misconstrued, was that the majority of kids, actually the main cause is bowel issues, which are causing bladder overactivity, and that can be addressed very early and oftentimes cure these kids. Dr. O'Regan cured his own son at 4 by using enemas, and his child had normal bowel habits, and the only way he was able to diagnose the constipation was with an invasive test. So what I say is, in all kids with bedwetting, is first evaluate the constipation and treat that aggressively. In almost all cases, in fact, 80% of the time, that will take care of the problem at any age once they're trained. If that doesn't work, then you can look into the other options, which include either medicine or alarm therapy, which are also highly successful.
Now, it seems like a lot of people are going to have to be making doctor trips to figure this stuff out. Is there a way to diagnose these things on your own as a parent without having to do the copay and get everybody
in? Yeah,
that's
a good point. I fixed a few neighbors just over the phone, you know, by saying if you're wet in the bed, there's no harm in just starting some Miralax or another other type of osmotic laxative and see how the child does, and most of those kids just get better just off that. We have some recommendations on how to do Miralax kind of clean-outs in the book, but you could even just start a daily dose or a low dose of Miralax to keep the stools. Well, we say we'd like them to be less than 2 centimeters wide, so thin stools, and to be mushy when they hit the toilet. And this is a weird thing for most people to talk about, but I'm kind of used to it.
Yeah.
But the poop, when it hits the toilet, it shouldn't be like a big log there. It should be like a cow patty, you know. And if you start that process, which will slowly empty out the colon, you most likely will resolve your bedwetting months to years earlier than you would have if you ignored it. So you can simply do that, and I bet you half the kids will get better just from that therapy alone.
Okay. All right, last thing we're going to talk about a little bit is diet that can help regulate and help deal with some of these issues. They talk certainly about fiber, but what else is going on in the potty training diet?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons, again, we cover three reasons in the book why we think these potty problems are prevalent in modern society, and one of them we think is just the highly processed Western diet. You know, I have my own kids, and I know how hard it is to get them to eat properly. You know, you could have all the right foods there, but you know, they may not want it because they've had a taste of the good stuff. So what you want to try to do is promote a wide variety of foods and whole foods, not so much the processed things. Kind of like if it comes out of a box, it's probably not got a lot of fiber in it. So if you can promote a good rounded diet in these children and mostly whole foods, then you will prevent at least the painful stools that come along with eating high processed, low fiber foods that can lead to the behaviors of holding. And that's important to start off very early. Now, another important point is you could have 2 children, 3 children, feed them the same exact diet, and they may respond to that food differently. Some may have constipation, some may not. So you have to personalize your therapy. I've got a little jaded in terms of using diet to fix these children because I see the children at the end of the road, you know, we're having severe problems. And typically just adding fiber, even if you had the perfect diet, wouldn't work. You need to add laxatives or other therapies. But before the problems have developed, if you can keep the diet high fiber, low-level processed foods, eating whole foods, then you're much better off to preventing these problems from starting in the first place.
Steve Hodges is the author of It's No Accident, Breakthrough Solutions to Your Child's Wetting, Constipation, UTIs, and Other Potty Problems. Steve, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Bye. I don't recycle. I mean, we can just find another planet for your kids to live on, you know?
Noted non-recycler Tommy Crenshaw talks about the future.
Oh, I can totally see finding another planet that can support life when ours fills up with trash.
As an alternative to recycling?
Yeah, an alternative. So we, like, don't have to do it. Recycling. There are lots of planets. Finding one is just a matter of time.
Many people say that recycling is pretty simple and convenient. A matter of keeping select items out of the trash. A lot simpler than finding a new planet, Tommy.
Come on, there's a bunch of planets out there.
Would you recycle on this new planet, Tommy? Or just use it up and throw it away, too?
I really don't have a clue.
Log on to YouGottaBeKidding.org and learn about all the ways you can recycle. Unless you're into lame excuses like Tommy's.
Hey, recycling's just not my thing. Starting over on a new planet? Now that's exciting.
Don't be that guy. Unless you want people looking at you funny. Log on to YouGottaBeKidding.org.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Been getting a lot of email lately from women who are dating single dads, and this is one of the ones that kind of sums up a lot of questions that people have. Dear Mr. Dad, I'm a sixth grade teacher, and one of my students became very attached to me during the school year. Her parents divorced 8 years ago, and I began emailing with her dad a couple of months ago. We started seeing each other, but didn't let many people know because we wanted to wait until school was out. The daughter got wind that something was going on and told her dad it was wrong for him to date her teacher and begged him to date anyone but me. I wasn't expecting this reaction, and we stopped seeing each other. He said he had to do what was in his daughter's best interests. I completely disagree with this because the girl has not liked any of the girlfriends he's had before. I'm absolutely devastated. He thinks she'll come around now that school is over, but I don't think that's ever going to happen. Is there any hope? What should I do? Well, being a single dad myself, I can assure you that dating a divorced father is never easy. That's what women I've dated have said anyway, and I know I'm not the only one. We come with plenty of baggage, and there are always unforeseen complications. Plus, children tend to be very protective of their dads. I found it interesting that they're often more protective of dads than of moms, and I think that may be partly because they see that moms already have a lot more social support than dads do. Part of the problem may be that the girl feels betrayed by you. Because the two of you had such a strong bond during the year, chances are pretty good that she looked at you with admiration and respect and even considered you a friend. To have you suddenly dating her father might have made her feel that you were maybe just using her to get to her dad. It's also possible that the girl is worried about betraying her mother. Most kids with divorced parents secretly, or not so secretly in a lot of cases, hope that mom and dad will get back together, even if that divorce happened long, long ago. And there's nothing like having dad start dating someone else to show a child that A, she has no control over the situation, and B, that her fantasy of a reunited family might never happen. So the fact that the girl really likes you actually muddles things up even more by making her feel that she's actually helping shatter her own dream. As far as the dad goes, you need to understand that his first responsibility and his first loyalty will always be to his child, and that's the way that it should be. And while it's certainly worth trying to convince him to give things another go, his primary motivation will be to do what's right for his daughter, whatever that looks like to him. One thing you can do to help both dad and daughter come to grips with the situation is to slow the relationship down a little bit. In other words, try being friends instead of dating each other. Well, of course, it would have been better to have started the relationship from this angle. Going the friend route now still might work by giving everyone a little bit of extra time to get used to the new dynamic. At the same time, be sure to give dad and daughter plenty of space to talk things over. I know you want to get in there and tell your side of the story and try to show them that you've got the best of intentions, but don't. Dating a divorced dad can be frustrating and infuriating, but the key to success is being very, very patient. Rushing things is only going to backfire.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Ever know?
notice when you have a baby, everyone seems to give you advice. From your mother-in-law, to your own parents, to your friends. But when it comes to the important stuff, like immunizations and protecting my baby's health, I trust my baby's doctor. She really listens to my questions about shots, gives me great information, and she works with me to make sure my baby gets protected. And that's something even my mother-in-law can agree with.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
My name's Rachel, and in 8 years, I'll be an alcoholic.
Kids who drink before age 15 are 5 times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults.
I'll start drinking in middle school, and I'll do some things I don't really want to do. So by the time my parents talk to me about it, alcohol won't be my only problem.
So start talking before they start drinking. To learn more, go to stopalcoholabuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hello and welcome to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show on AFN. I'm Armin Brott. You know, a lot of books on relationships and marriage give men a bad rap, kind of making them out to be commitment phobic, not in touch with their feelings, or inattentive to women. In our second segment, we're going to turn conventional wisdom on its head and talk about marriage from men's perspective. But before we get to that, we're going to get a little insight into some other aspects of men's minds with my guest Neil Chethick, who's the author of Voicemail, What Husbands Really Think About Their Marriages, Their Wives, Sex, Housework, and Commitment. Neil, thanks for joining us this morning on Positive Parenting.
Thank you for having me, Armin.
So, again, you're looking at kind of what it is that we think. And on the way over here, we were kind of talking about that a little bit. And tell us, what's the most interesting thing that you found? You did a lot of research for this book.
Yes, I ended up interviewing about 60 or 70 men in depth. And I also did a national survey of American husbands of all ages and races and backgrounds, up to 300 men. And one of the things that struck me was how much men like being married. You know, there's out in the air there, there's he isn't that into you. But in terms, what I found was in terms of marriage, he is into you. He is into his wife. Now, the signs are a little bit different than maybe women would like to have. They'd like to know a little bit more directly sometimes. But men, when I ask them the question, are you very happy in your marriage? They ended up being 67% saying they were very happy, and more than 90% saying they would marry the same woman again.
But you'd kind of discovered that there's a different language in a way, that we're talking about things in a different way, that we're expressing love in a different way, we're expecting to have love expressed to us in a different way.
Right. Men are much more active than women compared to the using of words. Men tend to put less stock in words. So saying I love you, saying little nothings, that's something that doesn't usually come very easily to men. Men also are very much into sharing space as opposed to sharing feelings. That is, they like to be at home with their wives, but not necessarily, at least most of the time, in a direct contact with her. And finally, men are very much in women tend to be more face-to-face in their intimacy. They like to talk, look into the other person's face. Men tend to be more side-by-side. We like to do things with our wives, have, you know, fun, adventures, go out, go hiking, do things side-by-side as opposed to necessarily talking face-to-face.
What about the beginning of a marriage? Did you find that there was a particular way, or not even a marriage necessarily, a relationship? There's a particular way that these guys found that this was the one as opposed to all the other ones, possibly, if there were other ones?
Yes, I did. And it was interesting because I asked, as I sat down with each man, I asked them, okay, looking at back at your relationship, tell me the first time you ever laid eyes on the woman that who would later become your wife. And indeed, of course, there was physical attraction in that. But soon after that, there came two other factors that seem to be very important. One was self-confidence. Did the woman have self-confidence? Did she feel good about herself? Did she exude that she felt she was a intelligent, exciting person. That attracts men when they see a woman who has that.
Who is self-confident and feels that she's attractive.
Exactly. Then he is attracted to her. It's as if she can signal to him that. The other thing was a positive outlook on life. That is, she was upbeat. She was not a kind of a downer. When men saw women who were excited about life, they got swept up in that excitement. So those are the things that once you get beyond the beauty, continued to attract men.
Well, but you didn't talk to exclusively men who were dating supermodels, though. So, I mean, so the beauty is measured in a variety of different ways.
Right, and one of the things that the beauty was what is men would often look at, what is beautiful about her? Not is she the classic perfect beauty, but what they would describe that they were attracted to a woman's smile, a woman's eyes, a woman's, you know, way of moving. And so attraction was not a monolithic thing. Obviously, there's only a, you know, half of 1% who are out there who are supermodels, but 99% or 95% of us get married. So men are attracted to women who kind of are whole. They see the whole person and want to be with that person.
Were you surprised about that? I mean, because there are so many stereotypes that we only have one thing on our minds, that it's all about looks and we don't really want smart women. And kind of what you mentioned in when you first started talking about this, about a woman who's kind of self-assured and finds herself attractive, that the stereotype is that men find that intimidating.
Oh, so many of the stereotypes that we think of, and I guess it was surprised me, but more 10 years ago when I first started interviewing men, I was more surprised. In more recent years, I recognized that these images that we have, you know, in the culture are not accurate. And so one stereotype after another seemed to fall down, and that was one of them.
Do you find some interesting trends or trends at all about what happens as a couple makes a transition from just being a couple, just the two of them, to starting to have children? Because that can be a terribly tense time. And I have my own research and writing about this that, you know, that transition to parenthood really, in a way, is a make it or break it time.
It is.
For so many couples. You either set the wheels in motion to have good communication and a good marriage, or you fall into what more than half of marriages do, where they get married within the first 5 years after having kids. I mean, get divorced within the first 5 years after having kids.
Yeah, the way you described it is just about exactly right. You've got to reimagine and then reshape your marriage at the point when a child is born. And one of the things that I found again and again was how important it was to continue to have the one-on-one relationship with the spouse, continue to nurture that, to make sure that that doesn't fall prey to all of the other things that are now on your plate, all the other negotiations that have to go on. So maintaining that ongoing connection through date nights, through having the child be taken care of by others so that you really continue to connect. One thing I did find was that the child-raising years, particularly the first 5 to 10 years of the children, is the kind of make-it-or-break-it period in a relationship, and it's got to be, there's got to be a lot of focus. It's also the lowest, the point of the lowest contentment for men.
Right, exactly.
We have to just recognize that that's going to happen to some extent, and it's going to be pretty jarring.
Well, the second possibly make-it-or-break-it time is exactly the opposite end of that, is kind of the empty nest stage.
Exactly.
When a lot of couples find out that they spent the last 20 years or whatever focusing on the kids all this time, and now it's just the two of them, and they have to get to know each other again.
Yes, and that is really crucial. I have a 12-year-old myself, a 12-year-old son, and from talking to the men that I did in this book, I became very aware that what I really wanted to, that I needed to do now was to begin that reconnection with my wife outside of my son. You know, he's becoming a teenager. He's starting to have his own real life every day that I'm not involved in. And so my wife and I really have begun to focus on what do we want? What do we want in the next few years? What do we want long term? How can we create dreams together that we can both buy into that will keep us together and keep us focused on our marriage?
What did you find out about affairs? There's so much out there. I just remember seeing within the past 6 months or so several articles which seem to indicate that women are hardwired to have affairs, or you have articles that come out about men are hardwired to have affairs, or and then they start bringing in all sorts of animal studies and how animals, you know, whatever they do, that has nothing to do with people. But you have found some interesting things. I mean, I don't want to say positives and negatives of it, but it wasn't always a deal breaker.
That's true. I'm not sure what it is that drives us. I think in 20 to 30% of the cases in the survey I did, the marriages, there was an affair by one or the other. But I did find, as you suggest, that there was a way of coming through it. And it wasn't a single way. It wasn't like, okay, you do it this way and you'll get through it. You know, sometimes telling was not the right thing to do, and sometimes telling was the only thing, and it had to be done. When I say telling, I mean revealing to the other person that an affair had occurred. But I think, obviously, it's the most devastating blow to a marriage, and there's usually has to be many years of healing and focusing. I did talk to several men, though, who had come out of it, were very happy in their marriages, had found a way to forgive and to move on, and mm-hmm. in fact, the affair itself had brought the marriage issues to the surface and allowed it to
be. Well, that's an interesting thing. It's one of these you never would have wished that it would have happened, and you certainly wouldn't use having an affair as a marital aid.
No.
But sometimes it does work out. I mean, there were a couple of guys that I'm reading in the book that said, you know, after the affair, we had our tough times, we worked through it, and then we had the 10 years were the next greatest time we ever had in
our
marriage.
That's exactly right.
Kind of thing. So,
well, because if you've been, pushing beneath the surface all of your differences and issues, to have them brought up and aired can increase the connection.
We hear a lot about 50% divorce rates, things like that. It's even worse with second marriages. How did guys who got into second marriages make it work, or did they?
Well, actually, I was able to find something that I thought was very interesting about second marriages, and that is that if you break down second marriages between those in which there are children in the house, that is second marriage where you've moved into someone's home and, you know, when a man's moved into a woman's home and she has children, those are the most difficult. When they didn't have children at all, then the second marriages seemed to do about equally well. So I really focus somewhat in the book on in that area on how you can be a stepfather in a way that will not damage the new relationships that are being built. How a stepfather can step in and not be a father, because it's really important that he not try to supplant the real father if there is one there. And that even if there isn't one, he can't supplant the image of a real father. He's still a different person, a different relationship
right,
than a father.
Right.
And so there's some ways that men who succeeded in making it through that transition speak about how they did that.
Neil Chethick is the author of Voicemail, What Husbands Really Think About Their Marriages, Their Wives, Sex, Housework, and Commitment. Neil, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Armin.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue our discussion of the inner life of men, but from a little bit of a different perspective. This time we'll be talking about marriage and how to apply the secrets of happily married men to our own lives. All that and more after the break. I'm Armin Brott, and you're listening to Positive Parenting.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hey, Dad.
What?
I can't get the ketchup bottle open.
Here, let me try. Yeah, it's stuck all right.
Anything?
Now watch. If you take your palm like this, and smack it on the bottom, right here. You can get it open pretty easily. Here you go.
Thanks.
You don't have to be a hero to be a hero. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To find out how you can adopt, please visit our website at adoptuskids.org or call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt US Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for the remainder of today's show is Scott Holtzman, who's the author of The Secrets of Happily Married Men. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Armin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Scott, so tell us about the book a little bit. I talked about this in the introduction to the show. I think give men a little bit of a bad rap about marriage, and we sort of think of women as the keepers of relationships, and you're suggesting that it doesn't have to be like that, and not only that, that men can actually take a lot of control.
Well, men have been labeled as the one who's not really good at relationships, and a lot of men have accepted that label. Now, the problem is when marriages start to fall apart and when things aren't going well, men say, well, I don't really know how to fix relationships, so, I don't really think I'm going to have much of a role in getting this relationship back on track. In fact, I think it's quite the opposite. I think we men have tremendous potential for relationship skills, and if we use that potential, we can actually help save marriages.
Well, one of the things that you talk about that's really interesting is kind of using the strength that we have in other areas, the strengths that get us ahead in the workplace, the ability to focus, our various other things that make us men, and putting that to use in a relationship in a way similar to the way we put it to use in other parts of our lives, but I don't think people have really made the connection between the two.
Exactly. I mean, if you take a look at what's happened in the past century, do you know that 95% of all Nobel Prize winners have been men? Even in the past decade, you know, with all the advances that women have made, men can be top in their field in engineering or in chemistry or in medicine or even in peacemaking, in literature. They sure as heck can be good at relationships if they learn the skills.
So do you think, though, that it's something that's similar to science? I mean, as far as learning something, that you're not going to get a four-year degree, I guess, in marriage, although you can if you're going to be a marriage therapist.
Well why not? But why not take the approach that it's something that can be learned? You know, one of the problems with relationships is that people think that they're swept up with the emotion and the fondness for another person and that chemistry, and they think that's going to take them all the way there. And if you say to people before they get married, sit down and learn about marriage and learn about the pros and the cons and how to be a good husband or a wife, and they say, well, we don't need that because we're so much in love. So, yes, sometimes you do need to take more of a scientific or more of a strategic approach. But that strategic approach isn't meant to make the relationship cold. It's actually meant to make the relationship better.
Well, so let's talk about some of the eight steps, or the eight ways. Excuse me, I have this cold or the flu that just will not go away. It's amazing.
It's been hanging around, I think, everywhere.
Yeah, I've had it for like more than a month. Anyway, I'm sorry. Don't want to bother you with my personal health problems.
Well, you know that I am a medical doctor, so I think a lot of people always seek free advice from me, and I say, you know, I'm sorry, I just simply can't do that.
Well, all right, so we'll talk about marriage instead.
Okay, why not?
So what are some of these, the eight ways to win your wife's heart forever, as advertised in the subtitle of the book?
Yeah, well, we talked about the first idea, which is really kind of a mindset, and that's to make marriage your job. You know, to use the same type of long-range planning and the same type of work skills and delayed gratification that you use at the workplace, you can apply it to the relationship and really come up with a good strategy. Now, once you have that good mindset, you need to be really engaging in behaviors that are going to make the marriage better. And the first way is to know your wife. You know, when I'm talking to men, I'm saying, look, you may think that you know her. You may say, I dated her a few years, or we've been married for 5 years now, I know her. But a lot of times we assume that we understand how somebody functions because that's how we function. So really take the time, observe your wife, get a chance to know what she's about, and you'll learn things along the way that will make you better at your job.
You know, one of the issues that I've always thought about this, that is, I think that men and women express and like to receive love in different ways. And a man might be doing things like fixing the car or doing some sort of stuff around the house as an expression of love, but his wife would much rather have flowers.
Which is why I do think it's important to learn your wife's language, because yeah, you may say, I'm totally frustrated here. I just spent 40 hours, you know, in the last 3 days working on constructing a basement stereo system for my wife, because she said she wanted it. But if that's not how she views love, then you're speaking
not
in her
work.
Language.
Yeah,
yeah, you
got
to speak in her language.
Is there any sense in this particular part of things, in addition to learning your wife's language, to try to teach her your own a little bit as well?
Well, you
know, say that this really is a way that I'm expressing love to you and try to accept it that way?
One of the main points I try to make in this is that my experience as a marriage counselor and talking with the men from the Internet, because, you know, I have a website called drscott.com. Thousands of people have visited and contributed and taught me about relationships. And the one message I've gotten is that your wife needs to know that you are committed and devoted to her, that she can trust you and she can rely on you. And until your wife knows, and you need to make sure she knows that every single day, and it takes a while for it to stick. When she realizes that, that's when, as a man, you can then turn around and say, now let me tell you how I operate. But in my experience, until she reaches that point,
where she feels comfortable,
where she feels secure,
okay,
and she feels that you have her main, that you have her happiness in mind, she's not going to be that interested. She may say she is, but she's really, until she knows that you're looking out for her, she's going to be less interested in what you need.
Huh, that's a disappointing thing.
Well, it's disappointing, but, you know, the divorce rates are 50%, and in two-thirds of those cases, if not more, it's the woman that files for divorce. It's the woman that lodges more complaints in the marriage, and in fact, women will express much more than men that they're unhappy in marriage. So the bottom line is, as a man, I can either say, oh, that's a drag, or I can say, okay, good, now you've given me an objective, now you've helped me understand what I need to do, let me do it. And when you give a man that objective and the goal and tell him how he can do it, it's not depressing at all. It becomes something to solve.
Well, so let's talk about sex. That's one of the things that's one of the eight ways. Understanding the truth about sex.
Right. Well, one of the things is that sex is not all there is to a marriage. And people, you know, may get married because they think that's what it's going to be about. In happy marriages, sex accounts for about 20% of the reasons that people are happy. But when people are unhappy in the marriage, sexual problems account for 50 to 75%
really?
of the cause of the conflict. Sure, sure. Well, one of the reasons is because when people start pulling away from each other, one of the first things that gets taken off the table is sex. And I really believe that that's a mistake. I think that even if you're not necessarily in that moment swept up with passion and full of desire for your mate, you should still continue having sex together because it's a way of communicating. It's a way of communicating for a couple, but it's a particularly strong way of communicating for a man.
But there are different sorts of things that are going on in the communication. It's kind of like that we were talking about before about learning the language.
Right.
Is that for a man, sex is kind of an expression of love in a way, and for a woman, sure, it's the result of that. The love comes first, and then the sex comes.
I think you're right about learning another's language. And look, let's face it. One of the realities is this is a book called Secrets of Happily Married Men: How to Win Your Wife's Heart Forever. But there are going to be millions of women that are going to be cracking open this book, looking at it, and reading it, and they should. Because one of the things it teaches men is how men operate, but it also teaches women how men operate. And men shouldn't be put down or be treated with derision because they happen to have a higher sex drive than their wife. And I don't think there's any role for a wife to say, oh, just aren't you over that by now? You know, I think women need to respect that that's an important part of who we are as men. And when men can learn the way to communicate that back to women, and that's why I say learn the truth about sex, because you can jump through all the hoops and you can write her letters and cards and bring her flowers, but at a certain point you need to communicate about what your needs are. And when you can do that in a constructive way, she will start to move toward you.
Scott Holtzman, the author of The Secrets of Happily Married Men, 8 Ways to Win Your Wife's Heart Forever. Thanks so much for joining us. It's a really interesting book. And as Scott said, it's got a lot in there for men and for women. Again, Scott Holtzman, thanks very much for joining us.
Great pleasure, Armin. And if you want to check out my site, see drscott.com.
And another website you definitely should be checking out is uslegalforms.com/MrDad. We all need wills, but so many of us just never really take the step to do it because it seems expensive or complicated. It doesn't have to be. uslegalforms.com/MrDad.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.